But from the Barbara Pertoni perspective, again, they're natural things. So anyways, I'll pick up on talking about that. So it might be worth, so it might be worth going over this picture again. So this is Barbara Pertoni clarifications. So we started, again, I'll just view what Barbara Pertoni theory is. And the reason why I'm doing that is because, well, to remind you, but also because in this, hopefully in the second half of today's lecture, I'll be able to start on general relativity, in which case we actually have a completely identical setup, but just the variables of the configuration space are slightly different. So this is part of GR as well. So we have this absolute configuration space. And this thing is just effectively a product of R to the D. So N to I equals 1 to N. And so it's just a tensor product of Euclidean space time, Euclidean space, spaces, digital time. And these guys, a vector living in this is the Q's particle positions, just the particle positions, right? So
you mean a Cartesian product?
Is it? Yeah, I suppose. Actually, what's the difference?
Differences that you would have. No, I guess if you think of it as a vector space.
Yeah.
You can see it.
So the way I kind of want to think of it is as these guys as being representations of the Euclidean. Right? So so we notice that these configuration space is sort of invariant. At least the theory that we want to define of this configuration space is invariant under this group action. IJ, UJ, I, where this thing is an element of either the Euclidean group, if we want to talk about translations and rotations, or it could be a similarity group, if we want to add scale, or it could be just anything else, some other general thing. So, for example, a general relativity, it would be the diffeomorphism group. So these Q's are. Vectors in G, right? So the picture that we have is that a solution to the theory may be some trajectory on the configuration space, but that there are these foliations, which are equivalence classes of points that are all physically the same. So if as you move along here, you're doing a rotation or translation, which is not a physically meaningful thing in the context of the area that you have. And so the motion of all these curves is generated by these A group action. So it's really highlighting this image of, well, okay. So the idea is that there's a projection operator that will map you from some point here down to a point on what Dewey likes to call the relational configuration space, which is actually very difficult to write down explicitly. We don't know how to parameterize necessarily the variables of this relational configuration space. But these are sort of the observable quantities of your theory. So for example, they could be the distances between particles in the center of mass reference frame, right? So those are things that you can actually measure in your theory. So even though your theory is written in terms of these variables here, they're defined with respect to an absolute background, the things that you can actually measure are over here. And so there's a sort of a projection map from here down to here. And in mathematics, whenever you have this type of structure, you get it's a five-dimensional structure. So your base manifold here is the relational configuration space. And at each point in this relational configuration space lives a fiber, which is one copy of this thing. So the fibers are the absolute configuration space. And then what
the fiber is G, no?
Pardon?
The fiber is G, no?
It's a G bundle, yeah. So the fiber is G. Yeah, the fiber is the group, I suppose.
And the whole thing is the absolute configuration space, right?
Well, not necessarily, right? I don't really know exactly the best way to think about this, but for every point here, okay, this is the picture. So at some point here, I might have my triangle, which is three particles, say in two dimensions. And then I can act, so that's a vector in this configuration space. It's a cube, right? So I can take that and I can rotate any way that I want. And it's not going to change. It's still going to project down the same point.
Yeah.
Then when I move to a new point, I have another configuration, possibly like this. So this is sort of, then I have another configuration that lives on the Euclidean plane, and then I can rotate that as well. And so what best matching is doing is it's trying to find a way to match this guy with this guy. But because they live in different vector spaces, this is the crucial, this is how gauge theory works, right? It's just like when you move along points, the tangent spaces are different. So because these guys live in different vector spaces, you need some way to be able to compare this guy with this guy. And that's what the connection does. Right? So best matching is a connection defined on this 5-1. And so that's sort of like the way of, I think that's the way of thinking about it. And so you make that connection dynamical, and then you get these equations of motion. So that's the picture. Now, okay, this is just sort of a the connection is defines as covariant derivative. So whenever I have a derivative with respect to lambda, it goes to d by d lambda. So what that's saying is that the d by d lambda piece is I have this guy, and now I have this new configuration. And then the connection is these auxiliary fields, like this. And this piece is the piece that's actually allowing me to rotate this guy and compare them in a meaningful way. So this is the best matching connection. And these guys are called the auxiliary fields. So now we make the auxiliary fields dynamical, and we make this substitution. It's a little bit different from standard gauge theory, because normally your connection, you don't think of the connection as being the derivative of something. You don't think of it as being a velocity. You think of it as being some, just some field A, right? And so you would do a variation with respect to that, which is a fixed endpoint variation. But it turns out that variation is completely equivalent, because in the free endpoint variation, we have this sort of mock constraint, what I call the mock constraint. And part of this clarification is that I'm going to change that terminology to be a mock condition. I'm sort of demoting it from, or maybe promoting it from a constraint to an equation of motion. But because you're doing a free endpoint variation of velocity, is the same as a fixed endpoint variation of a Lagrange multiplier, which is sort of the rocket that appears when you take the derivative off of it. So it's kind of interesting that even though the perspective is slightly different, the actual variation is but anyway, so we defined an action which was an integral over lambda, and then we had a metric that was defined on the absolute configuration space. But then we evaluated that at the this covariant derivative of the cubes. Okay. So this is sort of like a distance. The action is the length of the curve on the relational configuration space. That's the interpretation. And just to remind you, this in a more familiar form, this is 2t times omega v. But the t is evaluated at these covariant derivatives instead of the normal derivatives. So the reason why I wrote it in this form is because we're going to generalize that today for general relativity. But effectively, the only difference is that we have a different definition for the metric on the configuration space. So, but now we have to do a free endpoint variation of the action. And this is the thing that I want to talk about, because I don't think I got this right when I first explained it. I had it somewhat right, but I had the essential, well, I had the right answer, but I don't know if I had the essential features really pegged out. So I'd really like to tell you the way I think of it now, and it's actually, this is, I think, a much better way of thinking about it. So typically when you do a variation with respect to a field, you write that the variation of the action looks like die by die L of the omega field minus d by d lambda times the variation of this guy, right? And these are the Euler Lagrange equations, and so that's why you want to have the Euler Lagrange equations that we use. But of course, there's this other term that looks like this thing, the surface term associated with this thing, which is dial by dial omega dot times the variation evaluated at the endpoints. But the reason why we have this surface term is because the reason why we want to write it this way is because this guy, the d omega is evaluated at the endpoints are zero. So this term drops out. But if we do a free endpoint variation, so we allow the these guys to be non-zero at the endpoints, then this term is non-zero. And the best way to write this is not to keep the surface term, but to actually bring it back into the action. And then, so to write it the way it actually is meant to be, which is di L by di omega times the variation of omega, when I turn this back into a surface term, and then do integration by power, or use the product rule, I get plus di L by di omega dot d omega dot. And in general, there can be sort of higher derivatives of the omegas, but in this case, and in most cases in dynamics, you don't have any other terms. So this piece here is actually what you start with. And then you say, well, I have very special types of variations that are fixed at the endpoints, so I can rewrite it with using the surface term, and then I get this, more specific, more restrictive equation. But in general, if I have a free endpoint variation, then in order for this thing to vanish, these guys are completely arbitrary. So that means that di L by di omega is equal to zero, and separately, di L by di omega dot. So you get these two things separately. And this is what I call the Mach condition. or I call it a mock constraint, but now I want to call it a mock condition. And I think from this perspective, it's clear that this is just, you should be treating this as an equation of motion. So you shouldn't treat it as a constraint and put it in the action of the Lagrange multiplier. That's the wrong way to think about it, because it's not this primary first class constraint that's generating gauge transformations. If you add the Lagrange multiplier, you're adding additional arbitrary fields. So the way I typically dealt with it is I always put the gauge where that Lagrange multiplier is equal to zero. But now I think that the best way to do it is to leave this as a condition, and then when I'm applying the equations of motion, then I use it. But it's crucial because when you're calculating Poisson brackets, it's very important that you apply the equations of motion only after you've taken Poisson brackets. And that's sort of the critical thing, is that whether we apply this before or after we've taken Poisson brackets makes the variables look different. This guy is, you kind of get by taking the normal Euler-Lagrange equations and applying this condition. So if I have this equal to zero, then this thing is zero. So then this thing has to be zero. So you can think of this as the remnant of the Euler-Lagrange equations after I apply this mock condition. I'll show you what. Well, in the Hamiltonian now, so this isn't the Lagrangian picture. In the Hamiltonian picture, you have to treat it slightly differently. So you do the same thing, right? If I want the variation of the action, what you do in the Hamiltonian is you define this new variable, which is the momentum, and then you require that the variation manage with respect to the momentum and with respect to the original variable. I'll show you what we get. What you get if you do this variation, then it's the same thing as remember the Lagrangian is pi times omega dot minus the Hamiltonian, which is a function of pi and omega, right? So if I take this variation, I can use the same formula, right? So it's di L by di pi, which is just going to be omega dot minus di h by di pi times the variation with respect to pi. And then there's no pi dot piece, right? So this is the only thing that you have. And requiring this to vanish is equivalent to saying that omega dot is equal to di h by di pi. And another way of writing that is the Poisson bracket between omega and h. So this is Hamilton's first equation. And you can see that with the free endpoint variation, this doesn't change. Right? So whether or not this variation is free or fixed at the endpoints, it doesn't matter. You're going to get the same equation no matter what. So this guy is unchanged, luckily. For the omegas, this one is going to look a little bit different because I've got the first piece, which is this guy, which is going to be minus di h by di omega, that's it, right? Multiplied by this, then I'm going to have plus pi times the variation with respect to omega dot. So if we had a fixed endpoint variation, then what we would do is we would turn this into a surface term, because we would try to get the derivative off this guy. And we would pick up a minus I. So we would have minus IH omega minus pi dot d omega. And then we would have this surface term. Surface term, which drops out to zero. So for a fixed endpoint variation, then you get the second Euler Lagrange equation, the second Hamilton equation, which is that pi dot is equal to negative di h by di omega. This is right. Which is the same thing as the Poisson bracket of pi with h. So this is Hamilton's second equation. That's how you typically derive that, right? But for the free endpoint variation, you can see that what we have is just that these two guys are equal to zero separately. So the Poisson bracket of pi of h is equal to zero, and pi is equal to zero. So because pi is equal to zero, this implies that pi dot is equal to zero, which means that pi dot is still equal to this guy. So it's still, you can still, this, so that in the free endpoint variation, what you have is you have h2 plus this mod condition, which is that pi is equal to zero. So these are sort of the equations of motion that you want to have. It's equivalent to what I was doing before, but now instead of treating it as a Lagrange multiplier, we just treat it as an equation of motion at the same level as this guy. So we apply it only after taking the Poisson brackets. And what are the ramifications of that? In terms of everything I derive on the board, it doesn't really change much, because I typically took m equal to zero anyways. But it does change what you would call the gauge invariance of the action. And it also changes what you call an observable, because typically people define observables as things that commute with the for primary constraints. But if you apply this, so you need to get your primary constraints right. And you need to take Poisson brackets without applying this condition. And then in general relativity, it's actually, what we'll see hopefully today is that in general relativity, this condition is actually applied before taking Poisson brackets. And it doesn't change the results of the classical theory or anything. But what it does change is that it changes how you interpret what you call an observable. So I don't know if this is really a profound thing, but certainly, so in a second I'll tell you what I think observables are in this theory. And it's a very nice picture, and it works very, very well. I don't know if that picture can be generalized to a general GR, because in GR we have a real issue with finding observables. I'm not sure that this will clarify any of those issues, but I don't know, I find that interesting. So let me explain what I mean by that. Alright, so if we actually do this variation, let me just remind you that we get. Effectively, what this does is it promotes, you get these linear constraints, which look like this. And so the way that I think about this is that best matching is a way of promoting Noether's theorem to a constraint equation. So a dynamical equation that comes out of the theory. And because effectively you have the symmetry in the absolute theory, right? So you would have another theorem associated to that particular symmetry. And it would say that you have a conserved quantity. And the conserved quantity would be this pi. One of the equations of motion is pi dot alpha equals 0. Well, is pi dot alpha equals 0 in the free, the fixed endpoint theory. So this guy is a constant. And then the Mach condition, or the free endpoint variation, what that does is it sets the constant of motion of the nether charge equal to 0. Okay, so basically what it says is that you get these constants of motion, like the energy, the total momentum, by applying the initial conditions. So you say, okay, the initial velocity of all these particles is equal to this, and that might give me some momentum. But what the Mach, the relational theories are saying is that any motion, for example, the motion of the center of mass is unphysical, unless you have a background frame to define it. So what we'll do is we'll have this condition that says that charge is zero, basically that it's not really a meaningful concept. I don't know if I have all this. Okay, so this thing is a primary first class constraint. So it generates gauge transformations. And I think we went through this actually. But the gauge transformations that it generates is it sends the auxiliary fields to some translation of the auxiliary fields. And then it sends the Qs to a new Q that is omega alpha minus epsilon alpha. So what it does is it pushes your auxiliary fields forward, and then it backs you up. So it's sort of like on the surface it looks like a trivial thing. And that's why Julian calls this the banal transformation. But it turns out that this is a true gauge symmetry of this theory. And this is also, in gauge theory, this would be the gauge invariance of the action. So that's the variation with respect to this guy. The variation with respect to the Qs, we went through this as well, but it's kind of interesting to review. When I did it, I wasn't sure about a couple of mathematical details, but now I'm sure that they work. So you get something that looks like Newton's equations. But you get these quantities here, g times q and tau. So tau is the ephemeris time. It's the same expression that we had before for ephemeris time, but it's evaluated at these variables. So you take the kinetic energy, which is mi over 2, but you take the derivative of gq, and then you square that, and then you divide by the potential value of gq. So it's kind of interesting that you have something that looks identical to Newtonian mechanics, but you have these g's. And what you need to do is you need to, in order to get the g's, you get this by solving the linear constraints. And I think that last time what I did is I just told you the answer, but I'll show you how you can do it for the translations. It only takes like one chalkboard. But it's really, I think that you can learn a lot by actually doing it. And because really what it kind of looks like is these guys, so my proposal is that these guys, the g times the q, are the observables. of this theory. They are the things you can actually measure. And once you solve the constraints. And one reason why we might, so these are the observables, this is my proposal for observables. Now, first of all, typically people call observables something that commutes with the constraints. So this one commutes with the linear constraint. And you can see that, well, let's just write it out. We have the exponential of omega alpha t alpha times q I plus some bracket with I alpha minus sum over I t I transpose t alpha beta q I. So, oh, I shouldn't have done here. So when I try to commute this piece with this guy, I'm going to pick up the derivative. So the omega is not going to commute with the pi. And so I'm going to get, pick up a piece that looks like omega, t alpha times g times q. But then when this guy hits this term, the q is not going to commute with the p. But because of this minus sign, and what I'm going to be left over with is t times q. But there's a minus sign, so I get t beta times g times q. And effectively, the g's commute with the t's. So I get zero.
Hey, can you go over that again? Sort of lost track of the first step.
Which one? This guy or this guy? Can I both? So when you take the Poisson bracket, it's just like taking equals one. So it's just like taking the derivative. The Poisson bracket obeys Lambda's rule. So it's exactly the same algebra as taking the derivative. So if I take, this is like taking the derivative of this piece with respect to pi. That's sort of the answer. So, sorry.
The Poisson bracket of f and g would be dd pi of f, dd q of g.
Yeah, it's
dd q of f, dd pi of g. That's.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
you're taking it with respect to the q's and pi's.
Yes. Yeah.
So in this, wait a second. Now the pi's are the momentum conjugate to omega here. So
yes.
What are the momentum conjugate to q? Your Poisson bracket shouldn't mix pi's and q's because pi's are not the canonical momentum associated with q.
No, it's p to.
No, but that's not what's. So you. So the Poisson bracket between f and so f is going to be a function of, you know, p, all the p's and all the q's, right? So p, q, pi, and omega.
Oh.
And f is and g is going to be a function of all these guys. And then you take, you sort of sum over all the p's and the q's and the omegas of di by di. If you have more than one momentum, then you take the sum. So it's di, f, di q, di g, di p, plus the symmetrization, anti-symmetrization. But then you also have, di f, di omega, di g, di p, di pi. So in this case, right, the q's commute with the pi's. So the only thing that's important, relevant, is this piece not commuting with this piece. And you get, you get the derivative of this with respect to omega. Yeah, that survives. Right?
Yeah.
So you get T alpha GQ. And then here, the omegas move through this. The only thing that doesn't commute is the q's with the p's. So you get the alpha g. Well, really you get g on this side, q, but the g moves over to 0. But the sort of the point is that with this,
why are you sure? I mean, these t alphas are not necessarily like commuting.
Yeah, they do. They happen to commute with them because remember, I mean, g is just an exponential of the t's, right?
Yeah, but you have different t's, and all t's don't necessarily commute with each other.
Well, it's the things that don't commute is when I take t alpha with t beta. These are the things that don't commute.
Yeah, and
but when I take t alpha with t alpha, that commutes.
Yeah, but the g here contains, the g's contain both alphas and betas. They contain everything.
That's right. But the way that you do it is you just relay, it's like a way of just relabeling the indices. And then you get, because it is just all t's, right? So you have, your first term is 1 plus whatever, and then you multiply by t, right? So then you just take those indices and you move them over there and you call the other thing t with the other t on the other side.
You can't do that.
There you go.
If I have, okay.
You can also check it explicitly if you're really bothered by it. Stick the rotation group elements in, or any group. The algebra elements will commute. I mean, it's the same reason why G inverse commutes with G, right? I can, if I apply the inverse to the thing, or if I apply the inverse second.
That's different. So let's take a concrete example. If I have exponential of 1 times, sigma x plus 2 times sigma y, for example, take the exponential of this, and then I multiply this thing by sigma x on the right-hand side, it's different than multiplying it on the left-hand side by sigma x.
Anyways, it's not worth getting into an argument about it right now, okay. But I can show you that it works fine.
Okay.
So they do indeed commute, basically it's the same matrix, so it's going to commute with itself. But you can, like I said, you can check it with the specific things if you want. In any case, so these do commute, and the reason why, so granted this issue here, it's because you have this structure that you have. Because you're multiplying g with this guy, and the combination which you're taking these things, they're going to cancel. Another thing that commutes is actually g inverse with p with the linear constraints. And so that commutes as well. And the t's, so now because these guys commute, because the tau's are just functions of these variables, the tau's also commute with the linear constraints. So the tau's, the q's, and the p's all commute with the linear constraints. And the secret is that we haven't applied pi equals 0 yet. If we apply the Mach condition, this guy, before taking the Poisson brackets, then these things would obviously not commute. There would be pieces left over. But treating it as an equation of motion, we shouldn't apply it before, we should only apply it after. And that's why you get this property. Now, interestingly, there's another constraint, which is the Hamiltonian constraint. These variables do not commute with the Hamiltonian constraint. They give crazy, ugly stuff that you don't want to ever look at. And so one might think that this is a problem. There's a rule should commute with all the constraints. But I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not that's necessary. Because of the nature of the Hamiltonian constraint, it's generating reparametrizations of the trajectories, but it's also generating the actual motion along the trajectories. So there's quite a bit of literature discussion about this. Kukoc defines two types of observables, what he called perennials, which are things that commute with everything, and then like the physical observables, which he says need to commute with all the constraints other than the Hamiltonian constraints. And I would say that these quantities are examples of that. They're examples of things that commute with the constraints and are observables. Well, I claim that they're observables, but they don't commute with the Hamiltonian constraint. So you can see already that why finding observables in GR can be tricky. But the nice thing, the hard thing about general relativity is that it's very difficult to invert, to solve the this version of the equation of the to solve the linear constraint, which I can do it. But with the with these simple models, it's very easy to invert to solve those constraints. And so you can actually see very clearly what these quantities are. So it's, I think I'm going to do that right now, just to show you, to basically prove my claim that these things are actually observables. At least that they make sense to be thought of as things that you can measure. So let's try to solve the constraints or the translations. Okay. So the constraints look like pi alpha minus sum over I pi transpose t alpha qi is 0. The mod condition is pi alpha equals 0. So now we're solving the constraints, which means we're allowed to use the equations of motion. This is one of them that I want to use. The other one is Hamilton's first equation, which is written as, I'll just remind you because I've done this earlier. It's just this guy, q dot plus omega dot alpha t alpha qi. So this was Hamilton's first equation for the system. And the generators of the translation group are like taking derivatives with respect to q. So so that hits this, turns into one, and what you're left with is just the dot of the omega. So this looks like q dot I plus omega dot. And I'll call these a's, right? Just to call them something. A dots. So if I use these two equations of motion and I plug them in, also like I think it's I'll just go to a vector notation with little vector arrows instead of the matrix notation for these guys, just because it's more natural now that we're dealing with vectors in Euclidean space. So using this and using this guy, we've got sum over I of mi over the lapse times vector q I plus vector a I dot is equal to 0. So we can solve for the a's. That's the point. So it's kind of trivial to deal with in this case. The other really nice thing is that in all these cases, the n drops like this. So you don't have to sort of solve the Hamiltonian constraint and the linear constraint simultaneously. You can solve this guy separately and then plug him into the solution for this. This is the solution to the Hamiltonian constraint. So you can do that separately, which is really nice. And what you find is that these a's, dots rather, are the negative of sum over I of mi times qi divided by the total mass. So what is this? We recognize it as the velocity of the center of mass, right? So this is q dot the center of mass of the negative, which means that if we integrate this up, the a's are just the negative of the center of mass plus some constant that actually winds up dropping out of the equations at the end of the day. So because you're always comparing two different things. So then we can plug this guy into, well, now we can ask ourselves, what are the g times q's that I was talking about before? Well, it's e, x, p, the position of the center of mass times the generators divided by q of q. And that's just shifting these q's by this amount. So if I've done this properly, it should be q minus q center of mass. Which is something that you can actually measure, right? You can, you know, if you're stuck with these absolute coordinates, you can form these quantities, and what you get, what you end up getting is just sort of the weighted difference between all the coordinates, the difference weighted by the mass. So that's something that you can actually measure. In fact, it's a sort of overcomplete set, because there are more q's, not all of these are independent. So if you're measuring, if you have, you know, five particles, you can measure four of them, and the last one will be sort of determined by the fact that the center of mass has to be, but the center of mass is in here, the last variable is determined. But that's okay, because what you can do is you can just arbitrarily drop one of them. And you can say, okay, my true degrees of freedom are, you know, the four positions of the four particles. So I claim that this is a complete set of observables. Still more details need to work with. So you can see in this that the g times the q in gauge theory, the g is interpreted as the holonomy of the connection, which in this case is the omega dot. And so the holonomy is basically the thing that's telling you how much, it's actually the inverse of holonomy. The holonomy is the thing that's telling you how much you've moved along a particular section. So over some finite region, the holonomy will tell you how much I've gone this direction. And so when you take the inverse, what you're saying is that, okay, I'm just going to treat that motion as pure gauge, so I'm going to back it up. In this case, the backing it up is just moving a center of mass coordinates. So it's sort of like saying that the position, the motion of the center of mass is the thing that's unphysical. I can't measure it. I'm just going to effectively use coordinates where it doesn't matter how the position of the center of mass moves. Which is kind of nice. I think it's a really nice picture. I think it's interesting to study what the analogous thing would be in general relativity. What is the holonomy of the, it wants to be the holonomy of the lapse. But I don't know if anyone would ever consider taking that quantity, because the lapse is not treated as a connection on anything. It's just treated as a Lagrange multiplier. So not the lapse, the shift. And furthermore, they wouldn't see it as commuting diff constraint, this quantity. So I don't know how much time we started about 20 minutes late, I think. Right? So I've only been talking for 40 minutes. Keep going. Do you want me to start general relativity? It won't take long, actually, to do general relativity, believe it or not. We got some time.
It's being recorded.
It is being recorded.
Yeah.
Oh no. What if everything I said was wrong? All right. Let's start GR. Just on the chalk box. it's not going to look much different, actually. I call it Herbert Bertotti geometrodynamics. Because it's the geometrodynamics is a formulation of generalization. It's sort of the 3+1 formulation of generalization. And Herbert Bertotti basically re-derived it, which I think is really incredible. I mean, they developed these particle models, and then they asked themselves, okay, what kind of relational theory can I create of an evolving three geometry? And the theory that they wrote down was highly non-local, and didn't look like it was anything like general relativity. But then Kukoc read the paper and realized, or Kukoc realized that they had taken a square root over an integral over space, kind of an analogy to the square root of kinetic energy. And all they really need to do is take that square root and move it inside the integral. And then they had this violin sharp Wheeler form of the action of general relativity. So I think what's interesting about that is that they actually had, they just made a kind of a screw up, but they redirect general relativity almost independently of the way GR was derived. It's true that they knew that they were looking for a theory of dynamical three geometry. But other than that, they essentially had no other inputs. So I think that's kind of, I was just thinking about this yesterday. It dawned on me as something pretty impressive. They were able to do that.
Sean.
Yes.
The square root was a mistake in.
I think it was just the wrong entity. I'll show you. Everything is going to look the same except for one thing, and that's the fact that three metric is a function of three dimensional space, whereas these coordinates are only functions of lambda. So now you go from basically a one dimensional theory to a 1+3-dimensional theory. And then I think that they were slightly misled about how to deal with those extra three dimensions. So they made the sum over, put the integral outside. Whereas I think that they should have made that kinetic energy local. And effectively, the way Julian likes to think of it is that the square root on the inside is the thing that's enforcing locality in the field. It's keeping the interactions local. And indeed, all the causal structure of general relativity comes from imposing that thing. So you could call it a requirement of locality, which is not present in the particle models.
So then is it fair to say that what they put in was not just that they wanted a dynamical theory of three geometry, but furthermore an assumption of locality, and then GR comes out?
Yeah, probably. I'm not sure. I think that's a good, a fair thing to say. You need to add it. That's certainly the way Julian would think about it. I think that's right. So it's also a really natural thing to do. It's not really all that natural to take an interval outside. I guess let me just say that it's not necessarily clear how to generalize now that you're adding these three more dimensions to the functions. But anyways, so this is the new configuration space. Okay, we'll look at it up here. So again, we start with an absolute configuration space, which is the configuration space of all possible three metrics. Okay. So this is a very large configuration space, any possible metric. There's a name for this, it's called the mean. But this thing is huge. So solutions would be trajectories on this configuration space. But then there are equivalence classes of metrics that are all related by three-dimensional Diffeomorphisms. So now, The gauge group is the Diffium group, which sort of moves you along these guys. And you have a projection down onto the smaller relational configuration space, which is, again, difficult to parameterize. We don't really know how to parameterize this. By the way, for translations, the R's, I would conjecture that the R's would just be these quantities here in terms of the Q's. But we don't know how to parameterize these guys necessarily. But nevertheless, we can sort of abstractly define this as the configuration space of all three geometries. And this is called superspace. People typically like to call this guy shape space, because it's the space of all possible shapes. So you get this projection from all the points along here to here. And so again, you have this fiber bipedal structure. And best matching is just a way of defining a covariant derivative on that fiber bipedal, defining a connection on the fiber bipedal. So the symmetry is now that the G's go to the lead derivative in the direction of some vector field of the of the metric. So this is a large diffeomorphism. Okay, so by analogy, you get this. The derivative of the lambda now turned into b by b lambda plus this lead derivative in the direction of the dot of the spectrum field, which is so if I have the action, so that this on the metric sends the derivative of the metric to the derivative of the metric plus the lead derivative of the metric, which in this case we're taking just assuming that the metric is compatible with is compatible with the response. With the connection defined on the manifold sigma on which the metric lives is compatible. So the connection lives on that is compatible with the metric. Clear. There's two different concepts of connections. There's the connection on this configuration space, and then there's the actual manifold, the manifold sigma, which has a metric, a three metric on it. Then you can define the connection on the tangent bundle, this thing, which is the normal Christoffel symbol. And you can say that the covariant derivative of this metric is equal to zero. And that's what you call a connected metric. So we are assuming that on this manifold we have a connected metric, so that its covariant derivative is zero. So when I take the lead derivative, the piece, you would normally have a piece that would be the covariant derivative of the metric, but that's zero. And what you're left with is the anti symmetrization of A. So the semicolon is a covariance derivative. But again, it's important to distinguish between the covariant derivative on this manifold and the covariant derivative that we're defining here, which is in the configuration space. So this is the symmetrization. So it's B, K. Okay. Great. So that is how the derivative, this connection on this space acts. Great. Great. So this is the thing that's going to implement our spatial relationalism. Now, to implement the temporal relationalism, we just use a Jacobi action. So just as before, we have a Jacobi action.
There's something I'm not sure. Okay. So what you're saying there is that by adding this kind of spin one thing to the then you can get you can do you, that that implements all the possible diffeomorphisms. This psi there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that it's a spin one connection. It's not.
What I'm saying is that but you have this vector thing which. You can describe all possible diffeomorphisms with a vector quantity,
right.
Is what I'm saying.
That's right. So this vector field is an exhilarative field. And it's implementing an arbitrary diffeomorphism. So just as the omega fields were implementing rotations or translations, this field is generating a diffeomorphism. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a metric at this point here, and we want to be able to compare it with a metric at some point further along in the trajectory. I don't want to say it for time, I just want to say it at some other place in the configuration space. But because there's a different bundle living here and here, we don't know how to compare. So the two different metrics are possibly related by you can apply diffeomorphisms to them. We want to compare the geometries, but all we have are the metrics. So we use these auxiliary fields to sort of find a way to compare them to best match them, in the same way we're doing with the triangles. And that will give us a notion of a distance on this relational configuration space. So it's telling us. If you give me two metrics, I can tell you the difference between their geometries. That's sort of what the connection is doing. And it's this thing that's implementing it. But it's a vector field at every point in space. So now we have a very different situation. I mean, this is really the only major difference is that this guy is a function of x, and this guy is also a function of x. So these are fields now, and it makes it technically much more difficult to deal with these things, but I'm not sure if it's hard to know whether there's a deep problem that this introduces, or if it's just sort of technical thing. I think it's more likely it's just more challenging. Now we want to define a Jacobi action. Which is just the integral over lambda times this is when normally what we would do is we would take the square root of the metric, but because we have these fields. We need to integrate also over dx, d3x. And then we need to put a factor of this to make it a volume of one. So, but once we've done that, then we have still the metric on the sort of square root of the metric on configuration space. Now this metric can be split into two pieces. It's a conformal factor that only depends on the metric, and then a sort of a kinetic piece. So we can just rewrite this as e by the lambda, sort of the kinetic energy times the potential energy. And this is what we have in the Jacobi. But now, in the Jacobi thing, we would have taken the square root over this entire thing. But now we move the square root inside this. Now we have this. So that's the sort of requirement of locality of this place. But if you grant that, then all we need, all that's left to do is define the kinetic energy and then the potential.
Sean?
Yes.
Can you tell me, you just said when we've now implemented the assumption of locality, but I sort of missed it, I wasn't paying attention earlier.
Okay.
You said that if we used the Jacobi principle, we would have expected the square root to be on the outside of the integral?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure. That's certainly what Julian did initially, right? Because in the Jacobian theory, you would do d lambda times the integral of the kinetic energy times the potential energy. So it's tempting to want to define the kinetic energy as the integral over this, we will have a notion of inner product on this, I'll go through in a second, notion of inner product on the configuration space, you know, times the covariant derivatives of the metric square, right? So it's tempting to define the kinetic energy this way, which is the way that we defined it before. Now, I'm writing it as the covariant, the metric feeding on these two guys. It's sort of like in the particle models, this was written as Q transpose Q. So the only difference from the mathematics is that when I wrote Q transpose Q, I assumed that I had an inner product defined some way, and that I take the inner product. So this is kind of like acting with the metric. So this thing you can think of as a type of metric, where I've taken the conformal factor out, and then I'm left with. So it's completely analogous to the types of things that we had before. But remember, there was a sum over all the particles. And I think that what Julian might have gotten confused about is to think of the sum of all the particles as an integral over all space. But it's a very different thing, right? Summing over all the particles is part of the inner product of this configuration space. Integrating over all the x's is just integrating over all the values of GF, like finding the whole manifold. So it's not clear whether or not I think this could have just been a mistake in the bar of the paper that really they never should have thought to put the integral outside. It makes perfect sense to put it inside. But in any case, this thing is local, this thing is highly non-local. So, nevertheless, I mean, this is a fairly natural object. So, is that clear? Alright, so I suppose the last thing that we really have to do is define an inner product on this configuration space. So this would be something that would take, it would have indices A, B, C, D, and it would feed on the derivative of the metric twice. And it would give a scalar quantity. The only variables we have available to us really are the metric. So we want to try to create a sort of rank 4 tensor with the metric that's non-trivial. So our options are fairly limited. We can take linear combinations of different quantities. You can take G, A, B, G, C, D. Or we can have the one where sort of A is combined with this guy, B is combined with this guy. So G, A, C, G, B, D. Or we can take just combining the indices the opposite way. G, A, D, G, B, C. But we actually only really want to act this guy on symmetric things. So, if we're acting on symmetric things, then these terms are equivalent. So we can kind of collapse that down to one term, which leaves us with only two possibilities. And then now we just have to fix these guys. But what we can do is we can actually pull out one of them and absorb it into the potential. So we could, it's just a constant anyways. So we can set one of them equal to one. And the standard thing to do is to set this to equal one. So we have G, A, C, G, B, D, plus, we'll just call it alpha, G, A, B, C, D. And so this is really the most general thing we can write down. And we have a choice here to make for alpha. There's different ways to think about it. You can keep alpha as a dynamical variable. And then you can find that you get these consistency conditions. I don't know if you remember the consistency conditions from the particle models. And it kind of forces alpha to be only one of two things. One of them is interesting for Julian and in the scalar invariant theory. But the other one is alpha equals minus one. And this thing is very standard. Alpha equals minus one is what you call the DeWitt's metric. So it's a very common choice for alpha. So we'll pick alpha equals one, in which case we have minus one, in which case we have this guy minus this guy. And that's it has a name, DeWitt supermetric. And it doesn't have anything to do with the superspace doesn't have anything to do with obviously supersymmetry or anything. So that's what we want to use to find the kinetic energy. So I'm almost done. Almost have time to. The potential is we have to form potential is going to be some function of the metric, but not its derivatives. And we want it to be a scalar because this guy is a scalar and we want to be able to integrate over it. And this guy is a three-form. So we want to have a scalar. We're sort of limited with the scalars that we can form with G. Now, we can use the derivatives of G, not the lambda derivatives, because the lambda derivatives are in the kinetic energy, but we can use the spatial derivatives. So the natural things to form used for the potential would be the curvature, the free curvature. The three curvature, which is a function of the metric and its derivatives. Or you could just have a constant. So you could call it the cosmological constant lambda. You could have other terms in here, but it turns out that they don't lead to very interesting theories. So this is probably the simplest form that I could pick for the potential. And if I do that, then my action, this guy, is equal to d lambda u3x for g, the supermetric A, B, C, D times the covariant derivative of the metric using this best matching connection. times g dot cd. And I take the square root. And then I multiply it by 2 lambda minus r square root. And this is the thing that is equivalent to the Beyerlein-Sharp Wheeler action. It looks a slightly different because in the Beyerlein-Sharp Wheeler action, this thing is a different variable called shift. And it's treated like a Lagrange multiplier because it doesn't have a derivative. But because it's a fixed endpoint variation, winds up being equivalent to the variation of this guy, which is free. So this is the theory that you get, and it's equivalent to general relativity in 3 plus 1. So general relativity restricted to r cross sigma topologies, where r is the time. I think I should stop there, but next week, I could probably just finish by going over the constraints and stuff and showing in detail that it really is general relativity. It's kind of interesting though, because if you have the Beyerlein-Sharp Wheeler action, you wouldn't think that this is a connection, right, on a configuration space. So you would never probably think of taking a telonomy. And even if you did, it's not going to commute with your constraints. It's only when you treat it as a free endpoint variation of this guy that the holonomy actually commutes the constraints. So you can treat them possibly as observables. So I said that was sort of one of my revelations while I was at College Farm. Even though I'm on record now saying that it might not be true, but it's interesting. It's really interesting that these quantities in the particle theories are these nice physical things. If you solve the constraints for the scalar variance, the quantities, the GQs are the coordinates divided by the moment of inertia, the square root of the moment of inertia. So it's something that's scale invariant. See a nice picture. Solving the constraints in GR is a lot harder to do. that's it, I think, for this week. I don't know, anyone have questions for this stuff? So do we want to do one more? Maybe? Yeah. Fine, yeah. And then I think that's probably good. Unless I want to have like discussions about this stuff after, but I think that's a pretty good overview of this stuff. With this, knowing this stuff, you could easily read any of the papers and follow this kind of
thing. Is there a paper that summarizes Barbara Bertotti geometric dynamics?
Yes.
The kind of brevity that you've done here?
I think that the original one, the 1982 one, is probably okay. Because it's short and it's reasonably short and it's succinct and it has all the details. The non-local square root is the one in the Nature paper.
Right.
And I think that by 1982, if Kukoc sort of pointed it out to them, that they actually had general relativity just by putting the square root inside. I'm pretty sure they had that by now. If they didn't, then you can have some email on to find the action. There is more recent ones. They have the relativity paper, but it goes into a lot of details that are maybe not necessarily all that interesting. So, well, things come back. They're interesting. But there's, you know.
Yeah, you're on record for some.
Yeah, I know. Julian would not be happy with this. But you can show that you actually get the proper length cone structure, and then you so you get the structure of special relativity out of taking the local square root. They go through all the constraints and everything. They go through all the mathematical structure to show that. That's why they call it relativity. Yeah, probably for the other thing is if you read your Julian's draft, you can get something. But right, do you have that copy of it? Oh yeah. But it's pretty long winded, I think. All right, any other questions? Cool. All right, so we're going to answer the last one.